Christ Jesus, the image of the invisible God. For unto us a child is born. The titles of Christ, Good News of Great Joy, the Magnificat. These are some of the Christ-focused themes offered by Ad Crucem this Christmas. Shop adcrucem.com for greeting cards, gifts, housewares, ornaments, music, and much, much more. Available from adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through word and art. Adcrucem.com, adcrucem.com.
Well, at first it sounded like a tragic case of workplace violence. A government organization, they're having their annual holiday or Christmas party. The next thing you know, there are shooters, there are 14 dead, and as many, if not more, wounded. Eventually, we discover, though, there's a wrinkle in the story, and that is that at least two of the shooters are Muslim. And that changes the tenor of the story. At least it ought to change it. Although other shootings like this, maybe not at the same magnitude of mortality, but other shootings like this have been chalked up to workplace violence, even when the issue has been raised about the shooter being a Muslim. Is there a terrorist connection to the San Bernardino shootings, and will we hear about it if there is? Joining us to talk about the shootings in San Bernardino, the demographics of the Islamic State in the U.S., and U.S. propaganda efforts against ISIS on this Thursday afternoon, December the 3rd, on Issues Etc., Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch and author of several books on Islam, including his latest, The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS. Robert, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be here, Todd. Thank you.
One of the suspects in the San Bernardino shooting yesterday worked at the place where the shooting took place. Is workplace violence going to suffice as an explanation for this particular shooting?
I'll tell you, the mainstream media is trying very hard, Todd, to put it over, but the facts just keep breaking through, such that just a little while ago on ABC News, Brian Ross said that it was a kind of hybrid workplace jihad, which is, of course, completely nonsensical. What, did he kill his co-workers for Allah? It's ridiculous. But those are the two possibilities, and now I think it's decidedly turning toward the other, that it's either workplace violence or jihad. And now the media and law enforcement are having to acknowledge that it really was jihad because Sayed Farouk was radicalized, as they say, in the mainstream in Saudi Arabia recently. And he apparently was motivated by Islamic theology regarding warfare against unbelievers. And the idea that this was some kind of workplace violence is breaking down in the face of increasing evidence to that effect.
This has been the explanation. I'm thinking about the Fort Hood shooting, although it was a military base. It was also described framed as workplace violence, too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, that is still the U.S. government's official position on Fort Hood, that although the shooter in Fort Hood was passing out Qurans the morning of the shooting and saying that he was going to do something great for Allah, and although he was screaming Allahu Akbar as he murdered 13 Americans in Fort Hood on November 4th, 2009, it was classified by the U.S. government as workplace violence, which prevented the relatives of the victims from being able to collect benefits that are available for the relatives of victims of terror attacks. And so it was really craven and unjust of the Obama administration, as well as willfully ignorant, to classify it in that way.
Although we should understand the complexity here, it may have indeed been this couple in San Bernardino may have indeed been a mixture of resentment and things like this, along with the fuel on the fire of their Islamic beliefs. Would you acknowledge that?
Well, the resentment might have just determined their choice of target. But the idea that you have coworkers who you don't get along with, which is sort of a universal human condition, and that you mass murder them, that's a big leap. And the careful planning that was involved in this militates against the idea that it was a worker who snapped and attacked his coworkers. This was very reminiscent of jihad attacks in the Middle East, where the attackers are wearing body armor, they have AK-47s, have carefully planned out an escape route, carefully plotted their movements all the way through the thing, and are armed to the teeth in the manner of Islamic jihadis. It all points in that one direction. And so the only thing really that might indicate that there was any workplace violence aspect is that maybe they really did work with these people and really not like them. But, well, as I say, we all have that kind of a situation.
Do you think that the choice of the occasion should be taken into consideration by those who are investigating this? Namely,
yeah,
I think
definitely.
It was a workplace holiday party. Yeah.
Yeah, and that Islamic jihadis hate Christmas. They hate the religious celebrations of non-Muslims and have often issued fatwas forbidding Muslims to give Christians the greeting, Merry Christmas, or to congratulate them on Christmas or Easter. And so this is just taking it one step further. Of course, it's part of Islamic law that non-Muslims must make no public display of their religious festivals. And so a Christmas party would loosely fall into that you have these Christians or nominal Christians even making some public demonstration of a celebration of the birth of Christ. And that is something that is impermissible under Islamic law and actually to be punished by death.
Turning to a subject that has been recently in the news, and that is a demographic snapshot of the 71 individuals who have been arrested on charges related to the Islamic State since March 2014 here in the U.S. The headline says the followers are young and diverse. One of the founding says the individuals range from hardened militants to teenage girls, petty criminals to college students. The diversity is staggering. Does that surprise you when we uncover the demographics of ISIS in the U.S.?
It doesn't surprise me at all. And the unifying factor in all of them is a deep commitment to Islam and to the Islamic teachings that mandate warfare against unbelievers. And so in light of that, the diversity is no more or less diverse than the Islamic community, which in America is made up of American converts plus immigrants from all over. And people of all ages, of course, can be attracted to these ideas and believe that it is their duty before God to wage war against unbelievers.
Is it possible for our federal officials or our state officials to kind of wave this off? 71 individuals directly related to ISIS, and then apparently many, many others under electronic or some other kind of surveillance on a daily basis seems to be a pretty cautious move on the part of our government.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that the government is in a very difficult position, because it will not, as a matter of policy, acknowledge the ideology that motivates this. And so it is tracking all these people. And, of course, the 1,000 active investigations of ISIS members or ISIS supporters in the United States indicates a broad support for them. But they have to deal with each as a separate and discrete phenomenon because they can't acknowledge the ideology behind it.
So what kind of profile did this new study create of ISIS in the U.S.?
Well, I think that the key thing is that this could be anybody, that any Muslim could undertake this. And this doesn't mean that every Muslim is guilty or that every Muslim is going to become a terrorist. But certainly the study shows that this is a kind of understanding of Islam that is held by a broad spectrum of Muslims, not just young, not just old, not just immigrants, not just natives, but all kinds of people, and that we need to confront those teachings and challenge mosques and Islamic schools in the United States to teach against this understanding of Islam that they ostensibly reject, or to be held accountable if they refuse to do so.
Where is this diverse group of people in the U.S., where are they coming into contact with the ideas of ISIS?
Well, you know, the thing is that they are all over the, they don't have to go somewhere in order to make contact with ISIS. All they have to do is go online. And so there's no geographical location that is safe from them. All they have to do is find the internet, and they're there.
What about the mosque, Robert?
The mosque is another problem as well. You know, for example, one notorious case was when a young married couple from Mississippi, and the husband was the son of the imam, the longstanding imam of the local Islamic center there in this wherever they were, Starkville, Mississippi, it was. And his wife was an American convert to Islam. The father was an immigrant who had come from a Balkh, Pakistan, and had settled there in Mississippi and then raised his son there. So you have all the demographics, you know, the native-born and the immigrant and the converts and the people who were born Muslim. And the thing is that the couple was arrested at the airport on their way to try to join ISIS. And the father of the husband said, you know, he didn't know anything about this. But you got to wonder, he's an imam. His whole life is about teaching Islam. And certainly he taught Islam to his son. Are we really supposed to believe that his son rejected the understanding of Islam that he had learned from his father, even though his father had just married a couple weeks before? And there's no indication of a rift. And so you see, what's much more likely is that the son learned his understanding of Islam from the father. And their separate surveys to leave the anecdotal realm and go to studies, we find, Todd, that four separate and independent studies since 1998 have all found that mosques in the United States, 80% of them are teaching hatred of unbelievers and the necessity ultimately to replace the Constitution with Islamic law. And so they do go to the mosques, they do go online, and we have to start to speak realistically about this and formulate ways to stop it.
According to the report on this study, much of the research focused on Twitter activities of about 300 individuals who are identified as American supporters of the Islamic State. And I note here, it says nearly a third of those accounts were said to be operated by women. What in ISIS ideology appeals to women?
Well, you know, I think that there's a great appeal among women to, just as there is among men, to believe that they're doing something that is right, that they're serving God, that they belong to a higher cause, that they are at odds with the outside secular culture that is obviously corrupt, and they are doing something to serve God in a real way. And that is something that is very appealing to all kinds of people. And, you know, we look at the treatment of women in Islam and think, well, that's terrible and it's oppressive and it denies them all sorts of basic rights. But if you understand that this is all coming from God, that this is what God commands, then you accept it. That's your place in the world. And that's just the way it's supposed to be.
Another story in the news from the Washington Post reports that the State Department, the U.S. State Department, is considering scaling back its direct involvement in online campaigns to discredit the messages of the Islamic State. There's been a review of their activities up to this point. One commentator has said that the U.S. counter-messaging operation is in disarray. What is this operation, and is it worth the time and money that it takes to do it?
Oh, it's just a useless exercise. It should be scaled back. It should be scrapped altogether. It's an attempt to counter the jihadis' messages on Twitter. And so it's essentially a trolling operation that American officials actually go on Twitter, and when jihadis are on Twitter boasting about killing or conquest or whatever, they argue with them. But the thing is that the United States government is bound as a matter of policy to ignore and downplay the ideology, the nature, the beliefs, the motives and goals of the jihadis. So how are they possibly going to counter them effectively, much less in a constrained medium like Twitter? The whole thing is absurd. It's just a waste of taxpayer money.
So is there a need for some kind of counter-propaganda? There's no doubt about it that ISIS subsists largely and recruits largely through these means. What do you think it should look like?
Well, I think that it should be confronting particularly their Islamic beliefs and saying to them that the idea that God would command the wholesale murder of people that he created is based on Islamic teachings, to be sure. But if they step back and think about the absurdity of it and try to press the contradiction, then I think that they would make more headway. But that would involve directly challenging the Islamic religion, and that is what the United States is not willing to do.
Why not?
Well, a stated reason is that we have Muslim allies, and if we start to attack Islam, then we will turn them from allies into enemies. And I think while that's possible, at the same time, our putative Muslim allies like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Pakistan, they are supposed to be against the terrorists as well, and they know full well, they know far better than we do, that the terrorists are working from Islamic principles. And so to challenge them on that basis, I'm not sure it's just a given that that would alienate our allies. And even if it did, I'm not sure how useful these allies are when you take, for example, the phenomenon of Pakistan getting billions of dollars, $1 billion every year over that from the United States since 9/11 to fight terrorism, and using it's funneling quite a bit of that money to the terrorists it's supposed to be fighting.
I'm struck by the fact that in other massive conflicts like this, be it the Second World War and the U.S. counter-propaganda efforts against Nazism and fascism, or in the Cold War against communism, the ideology of the opponent was exactly the focus of U.S. messaging. And it seems to me that this is a totally hands-off approach on the ideology of ISIS.
Yes, it's complete difference. We say nothing about Islamic Jihad. We deny that there is this problem at all. I mean, I think most notoriously, in the Obama administration, the jihadis are tried in U.S. courts as if they were all criminals. They were all people who just broke the law. You know, we didn't bring every Nazi officer over here and try him in a U.S. court. They were prisoners of war. It was understood that they were at war with the United States, and so they were tried as such in military court. But now, see, there's no war. And because there's no war, we act as if that each one of these people is some sort of a separate and discrete lawbreaker. And that all stems from the fact that we cannot acknowledge or will not acknowledge the guiding and motivating ideology behind all this.
Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch, author of several books on Islam, including his latest, The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Robert, thank you again for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you, Todd.
When we come back, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway of The Federalist will join us. She has written recently about media mockery of prayer in the aftermath of the San Bernardino shooting. We'll find out what she's concerned about right after this.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.